Berkeley, and now I'm from...
Oh, you are at Berkeley.
So I'm moving up and down the coast.
Probably the most beautiful cities.
But I've tried to
get started, folks.
Let's go. Please take your places. Ed Lazowska is going to be the moderator for this session. Ed has been a great member of our committee, and we have a very distinguished panel, one of whom would be joining us by phone. I think we've arranged for good amplification of the commentary. This session is on alternatives to intellectual property-based revenue-generating licenses in promoting technology transfer. Ed?
Great. Well, thanks very much. I'll provide just a bit of introduction. First of all, I want to thank Kathy Koo from Stanford for co-organizing this panel. I have the privilege of being the one sitting up here, but Kathy has done a huge amount of the work, so thanks very much, and I hope she'll be very active as we move forward. The goal of this panel actually, I think, was nicely summarized by Z at the end of the last panel when she said, we're dealing here with a small slice of the pie. And I think the goal of this panel really is to look at the rest of the pie. The objective of university technology transfer process is transferring knowledge to the public good. And there's a long history of that transfer by lots of means, by publication, by consulting for established companies, by the mobility of students and faculty to existing companies or to new companies, sometimes with ideas they carry with them, sometimes with ideas from elsewhere, by consortia in which participating companies receive non-exclusive royalty-free licenses, by open source, by commons, and by revenue-bearing licenses, either to startups or to established companies, and the revenue could be in the form of cash or royalty or equity. And we have a tendency to focus on the latter, that is, revenue-bearing licenses and startups and as the principal form of tech transfer. And the goal of this panel is simply to put that in perspective. Universities play a lot of important roles in the innovation ecosystem. What are the roles? What are the means by which knowledge is transferred to the public good? How do you measure success? I think my eye-opener on this was about 15 years ago, I led a group of 100 people from Seattle down to the Bay Area for a day at UCSF looking at tech transfer in biotech and a day at Stanford looking at tech transfer in information technology. And Jim Gibbons, who was the Dean of Engineering at Stanford at the time, was on a panel that I put together, and one of the folks from Seattle, unfortunately our Vice Provost for Research at the time, said to Gibbons, well, if your tech transfer is so great, how come your revenues are so low? And Gibbons got this astonished look on his face and explained that that wasn't the point, that the goal was to create a technology-rich environment that benefited all and hopefully benefited Stanford disproportionately. And what he said was, if we told Hewlett and Packard what the license fee was, they would have paid it off decades ago. And as it is, they have no idea what it's going to cost them. Right? And I think that's an important way to look at this. What we've got here is four people, only three of whom are visible, who can look at this from different perspectives. From the venture perspective, Forrest Baskett from New Enterprise Associates was going to join us, but sent a note about 24 hours ago saying that he had a set of companies that were unfortunately on fire right now, and he needed to stay in California. So Steve Lazarus has been kind enough to join a second panel on a different topic today. So Steve, thank you for being here. From the university tech transfer perspective, we've got Dana Bostrom, who you've again heard before from the University of Washington and then UC Berkeley and now Portland State. From a company that has worked closely with universities in tech transfer, we have John Managanori, who had his plane canceled this morning. So John has been kind enough to join us by telephone. He got to the airport, and we got a note from his secretary at a number of hours ago saying that the plane was delayed and then delayed again and then delayed again. So he's back at his office and will do his best to participate by phone. And finally, Artie Rye from the Duke University School of Law is a scholar who's looked at the Bayh-Dole Act and tech transfer in universities in general. So we hope to be able to look at this question from all the different angles and have a lot of interaction with you folks. So let me begin by just going down the three-and-a-half-person line here and have folks say just a few words, and then we'll begin discussing with you. Steve?
The If you've ever been to an opera in Italy, you will see occasionally that after the soprano sings, there are shouts from the upper balcony of bis, bis, which means again, again. And I asked a friend who I was attending the opera with, what does it mean? And they're saying again, 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 because they're going to keep her there until they get it right. So therefore, I appear before you again. I'll tell you briefly where I stand on this, where I stand right now until you all modify my opinion.
Yeah, that's going to happen.
When I began at Arch, I was interviewed by a team of trustees from the University of Chicago, very high-powered team, the chairman of Amoco, the CEO of Amoco, the CEO of Northwest Airlines, the vice chairman of RACAM, and a few other people. And they were debating how they would measure the success or failure of what I was about to do. There was not much precedent for what they were asking me to do. And I was asked to create jobs in the community, to make a somewhat undefined contribution to society, which they couldn't quite pin down how they would measure, to certainly contribute to the academic richness of the University of Chicago curriculum, and, oh yes, make money. So I went out and thought about how I would set up to do this. I could confer with the entire organization because I was the only employee. And what I concluded, at least my going-in hypothesis, was I'm going to try at least to pay back the investment that the university is making to get this mechanism started, and maybe do a little better than that, and hope that the other goals would be achieved derivatively from that effort. And that's where I began, and frankly, that's where I ended, and that's where I am today.
Great. Artie?
So thanks to Ed for inviting me to this wonderful occasion. I just have a few thoughts based upon some themes to which Ed has already alluded regarding optimal mechanisms for commercialization in different areas of technology. As we all know from the patent reform wars of the last few years, patents are thought of very differently in different industries. Life sciences think of them very differently from IT. And there's pretty good empirical evidence, particularly for large firms, that patents play a very different role for innovation in the life sciences than they do in IT. For smaller firms, VC-backed firms, the evidence is less overwhelming, but still, even in the VC context, there's some evidence that patents are much more important for the life sciences than for IT. So one of the thoughts that that led some of us to, and Bhavan Sampat is in the audience, and he's very much a co-author on the, in fact, more than a co-author, really one of the lead people on this empirical study that we have been doing, looking at how universities treat software in particular, because software is, within the IT space, perhaps the area of greatest controversy. As some of you may know, the Federal Circuit, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, just decided a case in Ray Bilski that calls into question, and we'll see what the Patent and Trademark Office does with that case, but calls into question pure software patents, at least. And so within our empirical work, we've looked at both software patents and pure software patents and how universities go about making decisions about patenting. Basically, we're currently working on revising the paper, so I will email it to the committee when it's going to come out in the North Carolina Law Review, and I'll email it to the committee when it's in a few weeks when it's ready. Our best data in terms of the regression analyses we've done on the software patents that we've identified, both pure software and software more generally, and we can talk about definitions if that's of interest to anyone. That's a whole subspecies of scholarship, believe it or not. Our university software patents issued in 2002, and there the reason the regression data is good there is we have data there for the size of the university tech transfer operation. And we find in our regression analysis that the most important determinant of the number of software patents, both pure software and software more generally, that a university gets is not computer science / EE funding or R&D funding in general, but rather the size of a technology transfer operation. Now, we're not suggesting that tech transfer offices go out and patent against the will of professors. In fact, our interviews suggest to the contrary, that professors often pressure tech transfer officers to seek patents on their inventions. But without a sizable tech transfer operation, it simply wouldn't be possible to get all these patents. So from that, we conclude that it's basically the installed base of tech transfer capacity that you have that determines how many software patents are being sought, as opposed to other considerations that might be more important, as in whether software patents are really necessary for commercialization in a particular context.
I propose an alternative hypothesis. I'm sorry to divert us already.
Sure.
But I know that the University of Washington, most software, regardless of whether it's patent or not, comes out of the medical school. So a hypothesis that's consistent with what you said would be that that universities with large medical centers have large tech transfer offices, and that it's the large medical center that causes the large amount of software innovation to take place, rather, and that software artifacts are not related to the size of the computer science department. I'm just making this up, okay? But I think it's worth...
We didn't, and Bhavan, you have to...
We could put a medical school dummy in there.
We could test that, right? Although we don't, medical school patents.
We have a medical school dummy.
That's a good idea. Dummy is a term of art.
Right.
Sorry.
Only a Duke.
Some medical schools, though, Bob and I take it, have their own patent offices, and so some universities have totally separate patent offices
for their
medical schools.
I didn't want to distract us. I just think it's
there's a little bit of noise as a consequence of that. Is that not the case?
That's right. So, we can look at where our software patents are coming from,
right.
Particularly pure software patents across the board are coming from medical schools, are coming from CS.
Right. But the non-pure software patents, a lot of them do come from departments that don't look like CSEE. That's absolutely right. Like there's a lot of medical imaging stuff, for example. And we're doing further research on my colleague John Allison, who's read all these patents, thousands and thousands of them, is doing further research on taxonomizing, and a lot of them are medical imaging patents. Another way to we've kind of massaged the data. We've looked at earlier years as well, where we don't necessarily have data on the size of the tech transfer operation, and we see there's a tight correlation between the number of non-software patents and the number of software patents, even controlling for all sorts of funding, whether it could be CSEE funding or general R&D funding. And we think that the reason for that tight correlation, although this data is not as good because we don't have data on the size of the tech transfer office, we think the underlying causal factor, again, is the scale of the university's tech transfer apparatus, which, again, doesn't differentiate by area of technology. There are interesting exceptions. For example, and this is not a systematic empirical data because it's hard to operationalize attitudes towards open source in universities. It's hard to operationalize that as a quantitative metric. But Caltech and the University of Texas, which have had longstanding policies supportive of open source, get many fewer software patents, pure software patents, than their overall patenting apparatus would suggest they should get, according to the overall statistical correlations we see. So there does seem to be some evidence that a pro-open source policy, again, this is more anecdotal because we can't operationalize attitudes towards open source across the board as a metric, some more anecdotal evidence that the universities that are more friendly towards open source don't have that tight correlation between pure software patents and all other patents. They do seem to do more differentiation. Now, the fact that a university gets patents without necessarily differentiating by area of technology doesn't mean necessarily that the patents will be used in a manner that obstructs commercialization. Let's assume for the purposes of argument that commercialization is the purpose of Bayh-Dole and not revenue generation for the university. But there have been some fairly visible cases of universities and university-licensed startups acting a little bit like non-practicing entities. So we didn't find any statistically significant data in this area, but nonetheless, there are some visible cases where you've had situations where these patents have been used in a manner that seems to obstruct commercialization rather than to promote it. And of course, we all know that litigation is only the tip of the iceberg in these issues, in these cases. What's really interesting and what's really hard to get empirical purchase on is what's going on in the licensing markets, what's going on before the litigation is ever reported. We're continuing to do some of this research for more recent university software filing. The Kauffman Foundation is funding us to do that. And so one of the things we were told is, well, this was a dot-com bubble phenomenon. Universities are not going to continue to file a huge number of software patents. But thus far, we haven't found any significant difference pre and post dot-com bubble. So more to come. We do think that there is some concern that universities aren't differentiating by area of technology when they make decisions about patenting, even though the empirical evidence does suggest patents play very different roles in different areas of technology. Thanks.
Great. I have more questions about this one, but we'll defer them. Dana.
I was very excited to see this panel on the agenda because I think this gives us an opportunity to really look at the broader sense of technology transfer at universities. A lot of the discussions in the last four sessions have been using the terms inventors, have been talking about inventions, have been looking at, you know, engineering and medical school. And what I think about free licenses and what I think about then what the role that they play in technology transfer, it reminds me more that Bayh-Dole doesn't require commercialization. It doesn't require revenue generation. It requires practical application, right? And practical application can be achieved in a number of different ways, and it really aligns us better with the university mission, which is to create and to disseminate knowledge. And technology transfer then is an extension of that. We already know how to create and disseminate knowledge to matriculated students, right? We have very good processes to bring those people in, to get them out. We don't have really good ways to matriculate companies or matriculate people into new innovation, and free licenses is a great way to be able to achieve that. Now, that doesn't mean that that is an easy sell at the university, right? Because my second day at Portland State University, I had a faculty member come up to me and say, you know, the university just won't patent all these algorithms that I have that are just these brilliant ideas, so can you waive them all to me so I can go out and patent them, right? So that was my opportunity to educate them about, you know, what algorithms do, how you can track them, and all these kinds of things, and talk to them about how we might be able to disseminate those in a different way to get at what the faculty members want, control, attribution, risk reduction, perhaps some revenue, but primarily to their department or to their research agenda, not to personal income, and then some ownership issues, of course, arise. And the other thing I think this gives us is, you know, not only talking to the engineering, but I've managed software, I've managed innovation in communication departments, in linguistics departments, right? In, of course, the medical school and, of course, engineering. But we have innovation everywhere around the university. We need to look at how we have the practical application of all those components, not just the few that arise to invention and startup companies, because there are ways to impact the economy, to impact the university's bottom line more than just the dollars.
Great. John, a few introductory remarks.
Yeah, first of all, it's great to be here by phone at the very least, as much as I try to not succumb to the mercy of the airline industry. But I'm an entrepreneur and had been the CEO of Alnylam Pharmaceuticals since just about the beginning. And patents and in-licensing and working with university inventors has actually been a core part of our business from the beginning, and it's often the core part of any biotechnology company's efforts from the beginning as well. You know, we have licenses to intellectual property for many institutions globally, including MIT, Max Planck, Stanford, Cold Spring Harbor, amongst many others. And it certainly is the foundation of founding and capitalizing a company in biotech, and is a required element of being able to build a company. Certainly having exclusive or non-exclusive licenses to intellectual property required to ultimately protect products is a requirement for investors to put their capital at risk in developing a new technology that, frankly, takes decades to ultimately mature into products in the context of biotechnology. And we have the benefit of having a strong group of investors, including Arch, with Steve's support as part of the founding of our company. So there is an important relationship for an innovation-based company like Alnylam to have the relationship with universities and their and the inventions from the academy to have access to those patents and those technologies in a way that we can attract the interest of investors, and then further in the life cycle of a company like ours, to attract the investment by the pharmaceutical industry, which is a required element of how we ultimately fund this type of business. You know, our type of business typically takes 10 to 20 years to be profitable and typically takes anywhere from $1 to $2 billion of invested capital to generate a sustainably profitable enterprise. So those type of timetables and investment requirements can't be done if there isn't a foundation of intellectual property, and all that intellectual property, certainly at the beginning, comes from universities and university tech licensing organizations. You know, from our perspective, the real benefit of that ultimately is the benefit to patients and the benefit of advancing these important technologies, having the money to advance those important technologies ultimately to the patient, and having making a difference in the lives of these people.
Great. Thanks very much. I think emphasizes the contrast between the biomedical sciences and software. You know, the advent of cloud computing, for example, Amazon Web Services, creates an environment in which you can start a software company with essentially zero infrastructure. Right? And many computing companies that you would think of as having racks of servers are on a credit card pay-as-you-go basis using someone else's infrastructure these days. So the time and cost required to establish at least certain types of software companies has dropped even further in the past couple of years since these sorts of web services have become available. So the capitalization requirements are dramatically smaller. So I think I'd like to turn to some of the questions we posed in advance concerning sort of the metrics of the process. And what I've heard in the past day, I heard Kathy Koo say that no one has ever evaluated her at Stanford. Things just sort of move forward, and you know, she never gets a performance review. If it were to go badly, she'd probably hear from someone. But so far, for 15 years, it's been quiet. I heard Steve say that what he was told by the University of Chicago many years ago was more or less mom and apple pie and academic this and that, and oh, by the way, money. And your decision was to pay back the investment and, in some sense, do it in a way that the other goals would be fulfilled. Dana, I know you've been working with Autumn on a new additional set of metrics for university tech transfer offices, and I think metrics are important simply because we're all sort of smart rats, right? And someone sets up an objective function for us, and we maneuver towards that objective function. And something you said yesterday is that people, in some sense, you know, as universities using SAT scores in ways that the College Board claims it didn't intend, people do math on the Autumn data in the ways that Autumn didn't intend, and that causes people to behave in various ways. So maybe you could start by talking about what the goals have been in your your process over the past couple of years.
Yeah. So the Autumn New Metrics Project has been working with Canada and the UK to try to better define what are the appropriate metrics, because what we're afraid of is the continuing use of the Autumn metrics, or if NSF releases their survey in 2 years that captures the same metrics, we're just going to reinforce that those are the things to go for over and over again. I mentioned yesterday that the UK released their report yesterday. Autumn will be releasing a similar report in January with some new metrics that we do suggest. What we're trying to do is get senior research officers, provosts, and presidents to talk about the larger impact of the university research enterprise, and that is in a lot of the things that are listed on the later questions of this, which are the students that are graduated, right? The publications that are produced and that get validated, that create the new science that we all need. The hard part is that universities do not create impacts directly themselves through their own technology in a lot of ways, right? We license them to others, we get them in the hands of others, who then do the hard work that we've talked about in the startup panel earlier. They have to do all the hard work to get that in the hands of consumers. Universities do not create products, so all we have is proxies to the kinds of activities that universities do. So the kind of proxies I know that a lot of universities are looking at are the number of active licenses, the number of active relationships, the number of innovations which are under management. And then, as well, of course, some of these other things of students that are graduated, students that are involved in companies that are related to the university. One thing that the UK really looks at is consulting. I never have been in a room where that's mentioned in the U.S. where I don't get a groan from university administrators who don't want to count consulting or document that in any significant way to legislators or policymakers in some way or another. So Autumn doesn't have an answer yet, right? What we're trying to do is work with Nostalgic and AAU to try to broaden the discussion that it is not just about the patents. It is also about these other activities that technology transfer engages in. But beyond that, it's about what the research enterprise as a whole, which means the business school, the students in the university in that regard. So I don't think we've come up with a magic bullet yet, unfortunately.
That's too bad. I was recently part of an exercise in Seattle where some folks were trying to create essentially a startup map. So the idea was to look at the existing companies, in particular in the IT space, and trace their lineage back. And what was interesting was the researcher who was doing this had as her focus the flow of people. And at the other extreme, the UW Tech Transfer Office has as its measure the flow of licenses. Right, and there was, of course, a fairly significant intersection. That is, it's often the case that individuals leave to do a startup and license technology that they devised. But on the other hand, there were all sorts of very, very strong relationships that were captured by one or not the other. Right, situations in which people left and started a company with no license, situations in which there was a license to an existing company that played a monumental role in shaping the direction of that company. On the other hand, situations in which there were licenses that really played no role of consequence in shaping the direction of the company. And it's interesting that there's simply no way to tweeze this apart other than to interview the individuals who were involved. There's no spreadsheet or web page that tells you what the impact was.
And the Department of Commerce just had a high-level committee that also was looking at innovation metrics and how you can do that, and they really acknowledged in the end you have to look to anecdotes for a lot of this stuff, right? So they changed a lot of their recommendations around how taxing is managed for innovation at the corporate level, but for the kind of impact we're talking about, they couldn't come up with anything other than you have to go to stories.
So I... Right, that's what we dismiss as anecdotal evidence, right? So I asked, what would you suggest the most important metrics are for assessing the impact of tech transfer in rank order? And that's a tough question. But if you had to pick the top five by which you'd like your office to be evaluated, what would they be?
So what I told my boss when I got hired a little over a year ago was that it's the number of managed projects, which to me means the number of people on campus who, one, know that I exist, right? And two, are managing their intellectual property rights to collect them in one place, right? So it's a little known fact, of course, that copyright happens when, you know, you write something down. So you often then end up in a university environment with 20 owners, right? And then you're tracking people down forever to try and collect all of those rights. So they know I exist, they are collecting rights, and we have agreed to some sort of strategy for how they are going to share their results. Now, federal grants require this in some way now to try to look at some sort of dissemination plan. Those I find are pretty vague, so this is more sitting down with people and say, over a five-year plan, what are you creating? What is the impact you want to achieve, and how do we get there? So managed projects, number of deals that I sign on a regular basis, and those are deals of any kind, anywhere from an MTA to a license to an interinstitutional agreement. The third metric I'd include is probably revenue I help bring in from any source of any particular kind, right? So I just turned what should be a license. The company wanted it to be a sponsored research agreement. We got it to a gift. And in my mind, gifts are the best color of money, right? So if I can help the development office create more gifts, I would love to do that every day of the week. And my boss and the provost agree with that. And that is a good thing. Now, the president, when he was hired, the first thing he asked me when he met me is how much money did I generate? So I have some work to do there. the fourth metrics then is for me would be more kind of unique number of industry sponsors, because for Portland State, we of course were a small growing research university. We have to diversify the number of companies with whom we're working. So the more that I can bring in unique folks, unique new relationships, the better that is for me.
You mean industry sponsored research, for example?
Right. Or even just, you know, new industry gifts would also be fine. Sure. So like the number of new industry contacts that we have. If I were at Berkeley or at Washington, that would not be the same metric, right? Because I would have different problems if I were at those two institutions still. And then in the long run, when I talk with university administration and I try to get out of things that are not generating income, right, because that's how I'm prioritizing things, the sense I get from them is what they value most of all is the positive press. So if that were kind of number five on my list, I guess that's where I would put that, is that I have to have more positive stories about technology or about my office or about what's going on at the university than I do negative about, you know, me getting in the way or negative conflict of interest or misuse of university resources.
So this is like your positive to negative ratio.
Yep.
Or something like that.
Right? Yep.
Can we ask one another question?
Please, yes.
Okay. So I have a question. Carol Momora has suggested that combining the sponsored research arm with the licensing arm at Berkeley has been very useful because that lets tech transfer people see the whole picture and build relationships as opposed to licenses.
Right.
Do you think that would be a useful intervention in other universities, or is Berkeley unique in some respect?
Well, I actually wanted to go further than Carol, and I would often have this conversation with her when I was at Berkeley, is that I would make every case manager handle every kind of industry transaction that one would have.
Mm-hmm.
So, I really appreciated what our Caltech panelists said earlier, in that, you know, it sounds to me if they have 5 case managers and 100 active inventors, they each have about 25 people with whom they're working. And my magic number would be about 30 cases, right? But when you look at a university technology transfer officer, they're managing upwards of 200 on a regular basis, right? So if you could really say, on a regular basis, I'm working with 25 people, I'm managing their MTAs, their industry research, their licensing, I'm having a better sense of how those relationships work together, which is what we all know is the most important.
So if I came to you as a faculty member or a student with an innovation that was mine in some way, okay, was you know, I'm a member of the university community, but this was not sponsored research in any way, would you manage it for me?
at Portland State, I'm going to say no, because I, of course, have been asked that already. And my reasoning is that, you know, I have limited resources like anyone else. I don't manage people's real estate transactions. I don't manage people's car transactions. So I'm not going to take your intellectual property either. But I'm going to point you to resources that might be able to help you. And that may but not be the right answer in the end, right? But most offices just don't have the staffing or want to handle the liability of taking on private ownership. There's enough legal liability with handling equity that people think is theirs, right? That I think getting into it in further ways might be dangerous. But that's my two cents.
Marshall.
So most university policies are going to say that all inventions must be disclosed to the university. And the default is kind of that the university owns it, and then there is a waiver process for the inventor.
That's the same point. So that's kind of different than, no, I won't help you with that. You're sort of making it, you're making a leap. You made the judgment in that case that it really isn't
right.
Something the university is interested in.
Right.
As an example, as a University of Washington employee, if I have a consulting arrangement with Microsoft, and let's assume that it's not in my area of university research, right? An innovation results, I have to disclose that to our tech transfer office, and somehow we have to deal with confidentiality agreements and stuff, and the tech transfer office would determine that the university had no interest in it. So since Marshall asked a question, this brings me back to your comment about software patents for a second, and that is...
These are great fun.
So I'll maybe slightly off the subject of this panel, but it seems to me that between Microsoft and IBM, the number of software patents that are generated is just orders of magnitude greater than the sum of the entire university community. And I remember being at a dinner with Gates in the early 1990s when Microsoft first started patenting things. And what I remember him saying, so let me not say that he said this, okay, was that the reason they were getting in this business was that IBM was sending them boxes of 50 patents. And they would have to spend a lot of time and money dealing with these 50 patents. And finally, a month later, they would mail them back, and lo and behold, a week later, another box would arrive. Okay, and the only way to deal with that was to get in a cross-licensing agreement. In order to do that, they had to have a patent stream. Right? And so they solved that problem. And one could argue that this is a mechanism that works against small innovators because... So setting aside whether we have a problem in software patents or not, and I think many people would agree we do, there is the question of whether studying university software patents can teach us much and whether they're a significant contributor to whatever problem we have.
I'm not suggesting that this is this study would help us think about the much larger software problem or issue. Whether it's a problem or not is, of course, a loaded question, issue that exists. The reason that I thought and my co-authors thought this was an interesting area to study was that software is, in terms of the case for patenting, perhaps the most the area that's most dubious, pure software in particular. Some people, and again, the Bilski decision, arguably, we'll see what happens with it. Some people would say that pure software shouldn't even be patentable subject matter. So Pure is just data processing. Now, we could get into a whole side discussion of what it means if you just stick a computer on there and say, oh, but this is data processing that it has to be done on a computer. And by the way, let me just say that that's a footnote in the Bilski opinion that the Federal Circuit said, oh, but we're not going to resolve this question. You, the PTO, do that. So it's a disaster, basically. But pure software would be just data processing, and the way we defined it in our article was if you're just using the computer only for the data processing piece of it, then it's pure software, and it's limited to data processing. Bob, did you want
to? Yeah, just to respond to your Microsoft comment, I mean, one of the interesting things about this complex is that, yes, so certainly Microsoft and the IBM have been asking why they're packaging software as very fast for business. The universities don't really have that.
Right. Right. Right, and so we were interested in figuring out, using software somewhat as a test case, are universities really thinking about the ways that patents work in different industries? Because software, pure software, is perhaps the least defensible case for patenting. And if people are patenting pure software in the same way they patent drugs, you know, that suggests to us that universities aren't making careful decisions about the economics. Maybe they're making careful decisions about the economics for their own budget, their own internal economics, but not the economics of
right. So to me, this is
practical
a very
application
interesting direction
or commercialization.
Because I think many people would argue that since many major tech transfer offices grew out of major medical schools, that is the lens through which tech transfer is viewed. So that's a really interesting question.
Well, and our hypothesis going in. I mean, just to be not hide the ball at all, was that because we were told this by folks from the University of Washington, originally Jerry Barnett and company, that tech transfer officers look at everything like a drug. And so we thought, okay, well, why don't we test this with the thing that is least like a drug, pure software?
Great. Any more, Marshall?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say around the axle.
Oh, yeah, let's not even go there.
I'm
having a conference in January on that case at Brookings, so please come.
But it was related to a certain form of software test called business method test. That's really what the case was about.
Right, but that's not what the decision was about.
That's what the case was about. And I spent a whole day with the Chief Judge Paul Michel and I on a panel just like you guys. His argument in the panel was that he wasn't trying, and the judges of the CFC were not trying to threaten the software industry whatsoever. What they were trying to do was make a distinction between tangible and intangible. And, you know, that's the argument.
Well, I mean, the language of the opinion, you know, any given judge is going to have his or her own agenda, and he has to get his or her colleagues to sign on. So the language of the opinion is a little more murky than that. I think that it's fair to say.
A couple more questions on this, and then
yeah, I mean,
return
this is
track.
Really orthogonal to the subject of the panel.
So it contains any discussion of statistical analysis
going
offline.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that. But, yeah. The point that you were trying to make for us is, well, there's a kind of a TLO size effect, and let's not even think about what might drive this, the omitted variables that might drive the
right,
size
right.
of TLO
right,
and so
right.
on and so
yeah,
forth.
Yeah.
Okay. But getting to the point that you're making, okay, there's this little differentiation in the university, which is your point, between how they handle, say, a biomed patent versus a software patent. Okay. Let's go beyond that. Two questions. One, if you guys have data on what fraction, and you should, or somebody should, what fraction of university-based patents are software?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two, okay, how should these be managed or handled differently, reflecting the differences? You know, we know about, as you know, how businesses handle these things differently, but are you claiming that universities should not patent software at all? That there's no kind of that there's no return, there's no social benefit to patenting software on the part of universities? Is that the way they should handle it? Or are you saying they should adapt to the particularities of the technology? And if that's right, what do you mean? How adapt? Mm-hmm. How should that? What should that mm-hmm. look like?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So, yeah, we for the years on which we sampled, we have data on the percentage. So it's about 13% for overall software and about half that for pure software, so 6 and 13, approximately.
So that's the university cap, that's about 13% of all university
cap. Yeah, for the years on which we sampled. Now, Bobbin, we didn't include medical schools in our sample, so...
Universities.
We included universities, medical schools, but some medical schools have separate... like MGH, for example, Massachusetts General Hospital, does not take part in Harvard's program. And so we could. No, I mean, we haven't, in our paper, we haven't gone there on the normative question of what should universities do. We think that we should have some differentiation, but in terms of the details of the differentiation, in other words, should universities never patent software versus patent it in situations where there's a case being made by the professor, say, that I'm going to have a startup based upon this particular patented or software that I'd like to have patented, and it's really important for me to have that patent to get VC money. We haven't gone to that fine level of granular detail, but it seems to us that that it can't be the case that you always need patents on software.
Philosophically, might you apply different rules to universities and companies based on...
Well, absolutely, just for the reasons that Bob and I talked about. You don't have a mutual assured destruction problem with universities, and particularly state universities, but I think it's really true for private universities as well.
Just bob around patents and software versus biomed, but that's, so I'm trying to understand, but I don't understand. So what, maybe some members of your audience who deal with this might be willing to speak up. So...
So one way of thinking about it, so from what I understand, the University of Texas lets the professor decide whether he or she wants to open source the software versus patenting it. So one model would be deference to the professor's preference on the theory that the professor is better suited to think about the optimal intellectual property protection for commercialization. Now, that is not necessarily the best model because the professor has reasons possibly for wanting patents that don't have to do with commercialization. You know, the Aeolus case from UC was a situation where I suspect the professor really wanted the patent, didn't do much with his startup, and then sued Microsoft for $500 million and got it, got the money. No, but you settled. I don't know why you settled, but you settled. You settled for $500 million, I understand. No?
Much less.
Okay, well, we can get into the details of that. But yeah, these are important questions. Like, who should... I mean, so the question is, who should have the authority and what criteria should they be using? And, you know, whatever range of criteria... are relevant for determining whether a patent right is necessary for commercialization. It seems to me those are the criteria. Who is best suited to use those criteria in a way that doesn't raise conflicts of interest? I don't know.
It seems we should have had a panel on software patents. David.
So, Artie, can you or
John.
John.
Don't forget
John,
him.
Can you ask, reasonable
Well, this is where business people will be much more helpful than I. I'm just a lowly researcher, and all I can say is that it looks like there have been lots of successful business models based upon not patenting or that don't require patents in particular the pure software arena.
Yeah, this is a market analysis on an individual basis, right?
Yeah.
So you look at, say, in this particular innovation, what is the best way to achieve the market impact, which is appropriate? And so that's what tech transfer folks do on a daily basis, and often with the developers or with the business school or with venture capitalists, mm-hmm. with whoever is at the table at that point, or calling up our colleagues or consultants when we need it. And we say, okay, is this market, are the intermediaries, you know, the companies who feed the bigger companies the right place to get this? Do you have to start a startup? Do you have to release this open source so you can get the standard established and then you create a market that other companies can serve in that way? And that's what we do.
But suppose your goal is simply to get it out there and let it be most useful and most beneficially useful to whoever wants it.
Right, there's no one answer is the hard part. I mean, that's always the case-by-case basis. When I talk with faculty who want the one answer, I say when you start doing research in the same way and you start doing research on the same thing as everyone else, then I can give you the one answer. And it may be the hard part that we're seeing too many applications of the patent model is that we have technology transfer officers who are handling over 200 cases. They see a widget, everything looks like a widget, right? You have to have the time to do the strategic analysis. You look at development officers. Development officers is all about the relationship, right? You have to establish a relationship with that individual donor, find out what's important to them. At Portland State University, we have about 10 development officers. We have 3 in tech transfer, right? But we're doing the same thing in terms of trying to look at what are the relationships around what we can do to generate the best goodwill and the best impact.
So, I mean, a higher level point that I would make based upon what Dana is saying is if it's a case-by-case determination, you really need to have a lot of trust in the person who's making the determination that they don't have conflicts of interest that would take them away from what we would hope would be the mission, which is practical application. And, you know, who is that person that would have the knowledge and not be conflicted? Or at least unduly conflicted? I don't know. I mean, that's a really interesting question, whether it's a tech transfer officer, is it the professor, is it some... I mean, we decided when we passed by Dole that it wasn't the government. but who it is, I don't know.
We found one thing we could all agree on. Darius, and then Lee, and then Z. Darius.
Yeah.
This is certainly true at the University of Washington, which is that the acquiring company often makes the determination about whether to pursue the patent and then pays the patent costs. And the UW co-inventor would be on the patent, but it's not a university patent in the sense that the university decided to pursue the patent. And I wonder if you've tweezed this apart in your analysis.
Is the CLO involved in this or not?
Generally, when you're transferring the
I wonder, in that case, would the university name, if a patent eventually was applied for, the university name even be on it?
So in our case, the TLO is involved. Uh-huh. The university inventor has his name on it,
uh-huh.
Right? But the acquiring company, whether it be a startup or Microsoft, makes the decision about whether to pursue or not. And we have dozens of cases like this in the past couple of years.
But if they don't pursue, then the patent never issues. We only look at issued patents.
Right.
So
pursued, you need to pursue a patent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I have a question for you on that, is the reason a patent becomes important because it's sort of biotech and everyone thinks, oh God, you have to have a patent if you're biotech, or is there really a reason to have the patent on the algorithm?
No, it's actually because genome sequencing is such a big competitive area, and we do believe in the future, someone working on copying that out and putting it into the process.
It definitely isn't. Okay, interesting.
Okay, Lee, you had a comment.
Absolutely, but I would have looked at using trademark instead of patent in that case, which would have cost a lot less.
And open source can also be used to, especially the GPL version, to, in part at least, secure revenue as well. I think there's somebody said there was a Caltech person here. From what I understand, Caltech does... When they GPL, allow a university professor to GPL software, they retain the option of ultimately forking the license so that some people can take a GPL, and presumably that would be without cost, but the non-GPL version is available at cost, at some cost.
It's about time.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And actually, one of the thoughts that I had as I was thinking about this further was, you know, case-by-case differentiation, if that's what we want people to do, that's expensive. And, you know, and in some respects, it's easier to use a one-size-fits-all model.
It doesn't work, aside from that.
Right. The fact is it doesn't work, but from a very short-term, you know, kind of perspective, it might be easier. Although, then again, you know, patents are not incredibly cheap to obtain either. So, you know, so these are, I think those are very interesting questions. I don't have a good answer.
And I agree with you. I mean, that's why I threw out the development model as well, right? That universities are paying for, you know, X number more times of development people than tech transfer folks. So we're valuing generating revenue in that way more than we are disseminating the results of our work. You know, certainly federal grants now allow you to charge patent costs to them, though I haven't talked to a single tech transfer person who've done it. Maybe some of the people in this room raise their hand if they have done it. but that's the only thing that we can charge, so that's the most expensive.
Steve, got a comment? Oh, Jerry, please.
Can I be a bit of a contrarian here? So I know this is an enormously complex issue, but we are talking about public. By the way, we've sort of gotten really close to this, but we have to jump on top of it, so I'm going to jump on top of it. We have publicly funded research, and the reason for giving intellectual property protection is not to generate monopoly profits for somebody. It's to protect the additional development, which typically must take place. Now, I know it is the case that licensing offices do not pay complete attention to that to the extent that they non-exclusively license anything. They're not following that model. So everyone's sort of skirting around this and saying, we need this protection in order for firms to make this money. That's not the purpose of licensing in public sector funding of research. And so, and that is the problem is leaving there.
I think that's too narrow.
Pardon?
It's too narrow. It's the mission is broader than that. Did you want to say something as well?
Oh, well, I'm going to ask you a question about your question or your comment, which is, so are you suggesting that in situations where the company or somebody says, a professor who wants to found a company says, well, maybe they're not these additional development costs, but a VC will not fund me, period, whether or not there's development involved, unless I have a patent. Are you saying that's not a legitimate reason?
No, because I don't think the VC will say, I will not fund you.
Uh-huh. So you think that VCs are rational, and if there's no development.
The VC says, I will not fund you, that may well be evidence.
Uh-huh.
This is going to require
okay. Okay. Okay.
Therefore, we need.
Yeah, then we're on the same page. Yeah.
See, and I would say that one other additional purpose is to make sure that innovation is used, regardless of whether that it requires further development or not. And so I think that we have many examples where copyright licenses have been used to control modifications that others might make, which in the faculty's best opinion, they think further modifications might not be the best, right? And so we have...
If you're commercializing the market.
But so the problem with that is, though, that university innovation is often 10 years ahead of the market. So do you sit around and wait for 10 years to see if the market's going to do something? It's the university's job to help generate and create that market in some instances, and that's where I think the university technology transfer is doing their best job.
I totally disagree with you. Yeah. The university cannot generate markets.
Yes, we can.
Generate monopoly.
No. Universities can generate markets in a variety of different ways. It's not most common. I would agree with you there, but it has been done.
Steve.
I'd like to have a few examples because in my experience, that is not true.
Yeah, could you give an
the
example?
The university is perhaps the worst possible agent to try to generate a market because it knows nothing about commercial marketing. Let me finish. The university has several other interests, but unless they look at the market pool that exists, or at least is incipient out there, all they're going to have is technology push, and I assure you, technology push does not work.
I agree with you on technology push doesn't work.
Could you give an example where you generated a market?
Okay. So free licenses is one way to generate a market, right? So you start sharing your free software with every academic in the world. Suddenly you have a market, right, that exists. And if you don't allow those academics to modify, to create any derivatives, or, you know, to share those derivatives if they do create them, then you can go to a company and say, look, I have, you know, 10,000 users or 5,000 users or however number of users that you can now serve in this way. The University of Washington did this with bioinformatics software, for example, where we did this with some software that's called FredFrap, right? Oh, yeah. And not only did it create a market where it spawned three or four different startup companies who served that market, it also established a new standard for reporting data in that area so that it allowed scientists to better talk to each other about that same data. And, you know, frankly, this is not rocket science. Right, we have several companies that are in this room who give away free products or reduced products to students to create a market, right, so that they can serve those market once they graduate or once they move on. So you're right, this is not something that universities do on a daily basis, but it is something that can be critical, especially for this very early stage innovation that you can use to develop with information assets rather than just with patents, where you're sitting on those patent costs for 10 years and then the patent expires.
Greg has been wearing out his arm over here. Sorry.
I'm Greg Kaiser. I'm up to you. One of the things, it falls on to, I mean, it's sort of like the discussion led perfectly to where my question is, which is universities know, I think I've heard, they don't know a lot about marketing. There's some success stories of how they might market. There's people talking about using open source, so on and so forth. Following on to the subject matter of the panel here, I'm wondering why I spent the first 10 years of my career going to lots of standards bodies, lots of standards efforts, and I saw almost no university participants. And it's like, that's where they could find out what the industry wants, what they're working on, what they're investing in. Why am I not seeing more universities using that as a forum, a non-IP-based, non-licensing revenue-based forum for embracing the technologies that they create? If anybody has any insights into that, I'd love it.
Just to pick up on Jerry's point, there has, your response was that the mission has changed. I mean, there has been a bit of mission creep, right, since Bayh-Dole. Under the Bayh-Dole logic, as Jerry correctly pointed out, there should never be non-exclusive licensing, and there should never be patents on things like, if you agree with this, statement on things like pure software that actually don't need patents in order to be commercialized, right? So an interesting question perhaps for the community to think about is if there are other reasons, we've sort of heard a lot of that here, but other than Bayh-Dole, where the Bayh-Dole logic doesn't apply, are there other reasons why universities should, as a matter of public policy, using taxpayer-funded research, be having a licensing? And certainly we hear these sorts of things, and it would be interesting to sort of catalog them and take them one by one.
So what are some of the other reasons?
Revenue generation, service to the faculty. I'm not saying that necessarily.
Recognition.
There's a question of whether you want that as a matter of public policy.
Right.
So you can put a lot of the things we talked about, right? Jerry and Marie's surveys have all sorts of motivations that universities have.
So is that a public finance type of, should we get some public finance economists to weigh in on that question? Because, I mean, presumably it's a question of whether raising revenue for universities, if we think of them as public sector institutions, through this model is the most efficient way.
And you can make the case. So it would be public finance literature is one place.
Uh-huh. Let me take one more question on this vector and then change directions. Please, Wes.
Okay, so the question that I have, we heard about metrics from Dana. What I didn't hear there, though a number of your metrics was there on this, but it is some kind of metric that would speak directly to social impact. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so where is that, not just for you, Dana, but there are a bunch of TLO associated folks out here in the audience. So I'd like to know where that is, where that plays in. And then that speaks to the discussion that we were just having, okay? Specifically, if
there can be a meaningful metric on social impact, what are the implications then for the right model?
Mm-hmm. Well, how about lives saved?
Lives saved is a great, absolute.
And there are many, and I haven't seen anybody do the analysis, but there are absolutely examples and metrics that can be generated around lives saved.
Yeah. But then what are the implications? And presumably this varies per our discussion across technology domain. What are the implications for the model you might want to use? Would that be IP-based? Would it not be? Would it be, you know? So I'd like to broaden this discussion to consider social impact and implications for the appropriate model.
So I know the next session is all about social impact as well, so I'm sure we'll get into more of that. But I was going to say, I think the problem I have with that, though, as a term, is that I don't think universities should be engaging in any licensing which isn't socially impactful, right? So to call some special part of what we're doing socially impactful is bizarre to me, right?
But should we be doing things other than licensing that are socially
I would separate lives saved as a metric from social impact, to be honest. Not that it isn't social impact, but I don't think that's the thrust of the next session. And it seems to me that you know, where I take your comment is that if the goal of university tech transfer under Bayh-Dole is putting things into practice, then the rationale for patenting has to be that it facilitates putting things into practice, as opposed to the fact that it accelerates revenue generation or something like that. And so one would have to enumerate situations in which your ability to transition ideas into practice is enhanced by patent protection.
Unless it can be demonstrated that revenue generation is the best way to have social impact.
The best measure, right, fair enough, great.
No, the best means.
Best means, okay.
Revenue generation for the university.
I mean there's always a tendency
fair enough.
To demean revenue generation as a crude and crass objective, without ever looking to see what the secondary consequences are.
Right, but all of this goes back to the public finance question of, well, revenue generation for universities is probably a way to have social impact, but is the best way to do it through Bayh-Dole or just by giving them tons of money through taxation?
Yeah, that's going to happen. Okay.
given who tons of money?
So,
universities. Just giving them grants.
Let me turn us a different direction for a second. We can always come back to this, okay?
But even more.
I'd like to explore means of technology transfer that don't go through the TLO, right? Because you know, Dana gave us a list of metrics for the tech transfer office, and at the broadest extreme, there are metrics for the impact of an entire university, and somewhere in the middle is entrepreneurship that involves university ideas and people, but not intellectual property. So, Kathy, maybe you could say a few words about this. There have been a lot of examples at Stanford's, certainly Cisco, VMware, things like this. It actually wasn't technology at some level, right? Yeah.
So how did these different things work? Are there commonalities across the, you know, across the experiences that did not continue to feature the
You know, my view is that we're not granted. If we look at it and we say that based on our policy, it's not ours, which is not ours. So we're not, you know, we have said many times.
So, Kathy, how many of those five cases did the TLO assist in some non-negligible way?
None.
And were those all five cases where you really didn't have an ownership interest, or were they kind of backdooring it?
No.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Uh-huh. Not that we're not the police. Our office is not the police.
But.
So what will happen in a typical case, if it's a big company and it's done well, it's a litigation and it's a portion. That's how it comes to our attention.
I see. So this happens in the course of some litigation unrelated to you. Right. I mean, Google was, the two students were funded by the NSF Digital Libraries Initiative. Yeah, so this is pretty interesting. VMware, Cisco, SGI, Sun, and Yahoo are pretty significant impacts of Stanford University. But MIPS was a Stanford technology, so there was a license, but non-exclusive.
Do you have examples, Kathy, and this is I've heard anecdotally, of professors using, for example, open source on their software without ever reporting it to the tech transfer office and then getting a lot of consulting revenue based upon? You're okay with that? Even if they did? Right. No, I don't think that's true across the board. But there are some universities where they're unhappy about faculty making a lot of money off of consulting.
So that practice can violate certain states' ethics laws, and so that's where it comes up. And, of course, Stanford is not a public university, and so that's why it's less of an issue for Kathy. But if you look at, like, Washington State, they have an ethics law which was based on a federal law which is so heinous it was struck down, but they still had it. And I think that just changed recently in the last year or so, but it comes up more with that.
So is that a fairly widespread practice of faculty open sourcing and then getting lots of consulting revenue?
I don't know how widespread it is. I run across people who are wanting to do it all the time. And again, the question is it the best way to disseminate that technology? Because as we talked about yesterday, you can't strap faculty to chair and force them to give you know-how, right? And if the best way is to share the software and you transfer the know-how in that way, the other thing I do is I license consulting time, right? So that is the way that you can have know-how transfer as well.
So, Kathy, how do you think your office's performance is assessed? Well, I don't know how to put that. Or what do you think you would have to do in order to have Hennessy walk down the hall and have a word with you? So great relationships and plant as many seeds as possible. Toss up a lot of darts and hope some stick. Right. Mark, you had a comment.
I'm Mark Callen. I'm on the panel. If your question was how universities engage in tech transfer apart from the technology licensing law, one thing that's common in both Washington and other places is a corporation setting up research labs. IP frameworks. We have Intel, Google,
So I know it. In the case of Intel, the Jerry Barnett, who you mentioned, actually negotiated the agreement under which I believe all three of the Intel lablets operate. So the Tech Transfer Office was involved in putting an open collaborative agreement into place that we could all sign up for.
Yes, or in our case, our software research on more.
Okay. Kathy.
Well, and as the committee knows, I said that the revenue that we measured today is on board that was at least 150 years ago. So there is no correlation between today's expertise versus the improvement of today's expertise. So if we measure revenue, we should be on board.
Right. And the autumn survey isn't causal at all, so it does give people the impression that today's revenue is from yesterday's disclosures, is from the day before research income, when it can span 10, 20 years at in some ways. And that's I think, what our scholars could do for us as well, is look at really, let's say, nanotechnology. How did that industry develop with the help of university licensing one way or another, right? So we have federal resources, you have inventions, then you have licensing. What are the non-exclusive and exclusive licenses that really seeded that? And you look at the timeline, that would be a useful thing.
So, Kathy, this is an impossible question, but if you look at Stanford's impact over, let's say, 50 years, right? How do you have any way to talk about how much of that was derived from technologies that were explicitly licensed? Do you have any sense how big a role licensing plays in terms of Stanford's impact on the Valley or the nation or the world or whatever?
We are in a nuclear winter of pension funds not investing in venture funds. unfortunately, Steve was very smart, raised his money earlier. What's happening is we're seeing a trend.
Because I knew.
Hopefully, you shorted the market.
Right, you should have shorted the market.
No, but I think what is going to happen is we're going to see a cut down even further in early stage funding. I think late stage will hang in there because some of the big funds also raised $1 billion funds recently. And so now tech transfer offices are going to have to figure out a new role of how to commercialize. And anything that was done 6 months ago or earlier has no relevance. That's the question. How do you see that coming, and what do you think you're going to have to do to continue commercialization?
I think this gets back to the sponsor research question, though, as well, that Wes was stating earlier, that this is all based on the assumption that the valley of death exists because federal grants end and industry doesn't want to pick it up. The federal grant process could look different as well, right? And getting back to Z's point is that if there were 5% of grants or a different kind of grant or different obligations under grants that required people to take it to practical application, you would have a different valley of death. I'm sure there would still be one.
Although I tend to think that the federal government is going to be very hard-pressed to spend additional money on anything as well.
Right, and it doesn't have to be additional money. It's more you look at the allocation that's there. What is the most important thing?
And who's going to administer this money? Is it the university?
I'm sure I can come up with a policy for you, but...
The letter of the general partners of VCs have no skin in the game. All they look for is the amount of capital. So the bigger they make their funds, the more money they will make. That may get interest if they perform or not.
You mean management fees?
Yeah, management fees. Right. It makes absolutely no difference if they perform or not. Now you say, who do you pay for that? The general partners. Stupid is what I think, because if you look at performance, you can see it coming. and they really aren't giving much benefit to society. That's not your goal. But if you measure success, it was said by the number of patients you help or the number of patients you save their lives. That's my measure of success. And it should be everybody else's. Make money, that's
true. I mean, if it's a Cisco, how do they save lives? If it's a company like you.
Well, I'm only a physician, so I have to look at that. I don't know what those guys do, but I do know that there are many different significant efforts, and that's very, very positive. So, how long do they get skin in the game? Make an investment.
Well, actually, most of the LPs these days require a significant skin in the game by the venture partners.
And they should.
I mean, in fact, if you look at some of the new funds that were formed in the last year or two, a lot of the limited partners have forced the general partners to pay in 10%. So if they raise a $200 million fund, then the venture guys have to put up $20 million.
Exactly.
So from a public policy perspective for VC-funded ventures coming out of universities, should there be some sort of practice or expectation or go down the path of legislation that VCs working with universities, that there should be some modest level at least of skin in the game so they are incentive to carry this through?
Well, some do, some don't. Most of them don't, wanted to put money in D.C. that was not an insignificant amount. When faculty found out about it, what happened? Faculty said, no way.
I'm not talking about the university of college student thing. I'm talking about the B.C.
Well, they should.
Well, that's what have that there be an expectation that the B.C. have skin.
There should be an expectation, yes. I mean, that's a put an expectation. Another issue, though, is should tech commercialization office have skin in the game?
That's an interesting question. But, I mean, who should they be forced to, or should this be something that universities agree upon voluntarily?
It could be a practice.
And then, you get into institutional conflict of interest.
Right.
I think money's going to be hard enough to get, let alone trying to make it more difficult. Okay? You can have it be a strong suggestion, their policy could be started with a statement or whatever, but if it goes as far as to say legislature or something like that. But nevertheless, I think in general, venture money is going to be so difficult because they're going to be more focused inward on their existing portfolios than spawning new ones at this point. Liquidity is in the toilet. And, whether GPs got skin in the game or not, the short-sightedness of building a huge fund solely to collect management fees means that they'll never get to, for those that depend on Terry kicking in after the investors pay back, they'll never get to it.
So it'll make SBIR, STTR, I'm sure, even more important to get back to the original question that spawned all this. And SBIR, STTR supports a wide variety of technologies, everything from a couple that I have at PSU that are looking at assistive technologies to help people with disabled, biotech technologies that are trying to push the next stage forward. And I think that's a little widespread.
So let me try and...
I agree with you. I see that too many times myself.
Well, I think it depends on where the SBIR money comes from. The NSF has gotten very much organized towards commercialization, and they've invited me on a number of panels. And if they have, I look at a startup, if they've had 3 or 4 years of SBIRs and nothing is coming out, we automatically just knock them out. I know that's not the case with DOD, and it should be. And then there's a great RAND report. I don't know if anybody's looked at that RAND study.
Yeah.
DOD SBIRs. I gave it, I would say that DOD has an F minus.
Okay, two more on this topic.
So, while I applaud the notion that universities should be worrying about things other than revenues and some of the things that are currently measured, I just wanted to say, it strikes me that we need to be careful not to be too broad. So I think life saves, and I think universities should care about their public health impact. Trying to say something about how good a university is at that, that's going to be it's really hard for a particular drug to figure out, how many life years it saves. So, and I just think it can invite a lot of mischief. I mean, how do you, BIOCs, University of Rochester may or may not have been involved in that. I mean, how does that count? Right? I just think it's too nebulous.
Can I just comment there? I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, it's true with Vioxx, and frankly, that can go against LifeSave. But many of the inventions that come out of academic research that are then commercialized by companies are life-saving medicine. So you can quantify it.
Yeah. No. I think you can. I mean, why don't we disagree? I just think it opens up the door to too much mischief, and you care about lives, you care about quality-adjusted life years. I mean, there's just a lot of ways you can manipulate and try to say something about the causal impact of the university on that would be difficult to do. But what I wanted to say is, I mean, some of the stuff that Wes Cohen and colleagues have done, looking at other ways in which university research impacts industrial innovation, impacts the economy, I mean, that is at a lower level, but also, in some ways, measurable in a much more objective way, I think that would be a useful thing to sort of set of data to start collecting. It's not clear that autumn is the right place to do that, especially maybe AAU or something like that
right.
would be
And Autumn agrees. We don't want to measure everything.
What's that? Right.
We don't want to measure everything.
Yeah.
Greg, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I get probably answered the earlier question in a different way, but universities are going to have a hard time finding, I believe that the economic economy have a hard time finding forms which to market spin outs and so on. It still occur, but what alternatives do they plan on looking at that they currently aren't necessarily tapping into to reach out, say, to industry or other alternative forms of marketing? Because I hear a lot of talk about we need, you know, relationships with companies and we need to, you know, keep those strong and so on, but I see that there's a lot of opportunity that's not being tapped into that they could be doing in the form of maybe forming their own consortia or participating in, you know, industry activities of that nature. So
let me twist your question a little bit and put the panelists here on the spot and the audience as well. The title of this entire operation, this committee, is From Concept to Application, Managing the Transfer of Academic Research Results. So let's substitute some other word for managing because we got too much management going on here. Okay, you know, suppose it was accelerating the transfer of academic research results or something like that. Then what should we say? In the eyes of you, the panelists, that is, let's go back to a top five list, okay? If we were to talk about accelerating the transfer of academic research results into the public good, right? And we wanted to consider the licensing activity, but we wanted that to be in the context of the other things that universities do. That is, we were not focused exclusively on licensing, but we're interested in more broadly accelerating the transfer of research results into practice and the public good. What should we say? And I think part of what Greg has said is, hey, there's a new environment, and maybe in addition to fixing what's defective about how we've been doing it so far, we're going to have to think of entirely new approaches. So why don't you write our report for us? You can start, Artie.
So to return to my broken record, I think what universities can do will really depend upon the area of innovation you're talking about. So in the life sciences,
let me back up for a sec, uh-huh. Okay? So one recommendation, okay, is differentiate.
Differentiate.
Let's just start
exactly.
There, okay?
Exactly. And there's an interesting question about, I don't think industry is a very good criterion for differentiation because within industries you can have software or, you know, et cetera. So it's technology that we're talking about, not industry.
Differentiate across technology. Yeah. So that's the first half of your sentence. Now keep going.
Oh, keep going, right. And my sense is that in the life sciences, you know, patents are actually necessary, but probably not even sufficient. I mean, there's a huge valley of death that is not being bridged, even with the most, you know, aggressive patenting. And that, I don't know where the money is going to come from, because my sense is, and especially in this new economic climate, you know, VCs don't want to do anything particularly early stage in the life sciences. You think they do?
Because we've been doing it for 20 years.
So let me come back to you in a sec, but let me just digress.
No, I think you have to be careful about sweeping generalizations.
Right.
Okay, fine.
So, hang on one second. So we'll get back to you in a sec, but I want to pursue this with Steve, because one question I wanted to ask you was, Arch has been notably early stage, and I mean, one of the reasons that we've loved working with your Seattle office is they're basically, they're geeks, all right? And they really love technologies, and they figure out the market, okay? So they've been very early stage and a great fit for my department. But
not only in computer science, but also in medical.
So the question is, have you become less early stage over the past 5 years or 10 years, or you've stuck to your guns?
Because we've established a brand. It's what we know how to do. And as soon as you start floating up the spectrum, you immediately get into an area of incompetence, and you're competing with people who've been doing it for decades.
But I mean, are you representative, you think, of the VC community?
First of all, if you spend your life in seed in early stage, you are so non-representative as to be deemed foolish.
Okay. So if
all I'm arguing is that it can be done.
Oh, okay. Right. But it doesn't seem like there are thousands of you out there.
There are not.
Right.
There are not thousands of any kind of
right, VC. Right. And it does seem that, for example, and this is something that I've been studying in the life sciences recently, so I'm sort of obsessed with it. You know, in terms of coming up with new targets for drugs, new protein targets for drugs, everyone thought the genome would yield throw up all these wonderful new targets, and it kind of has, but we're still, it looks like, focusing on the same 500 or so that we focused on before the genome was sequenced. And so there's a huge valley of death problem there, because even with patents on targets, VCs aren't eager to, and you guys can tell me if I'm wrong about this, aren't eager to invest just on targets.
So
on
what targets. Would you have us say about this?
Well, you need money.
And I mean, we've got somebody there who says that there's a business to be made, and it's really hard to do. And if it's that hard to do, that may be why there isn't money. I mean, is the market working, I guess?
The market considers seed and early stage as the most difficult corner, therefore the highest risk corner. And as I said earlier, anybody who engages in it constantly, you know, is subject for examination.
But it doesn't necessarily follow that the money ought to go there.
Right. No, so one of the questions that I get asked in response.
But the market will determine where the money goes.
Right.
Is that, well, maybe in the life sciences, you know, these 500 targets are all we have, and any other targets are just going to end up yielding nothing. So, you know, but that's a scientific question, and I don't have the expertise to answer that, but it seems to me that it's hard to imagine that the 500 we were able to get before the genomics revolution is all we can ever get. You know,
so help me out. Accelerating the transfer of academic research results. The first thing we say is differentiate across technologies.
The second thing is in the life sciences, there's going to have to be some additional funding for the Valley of Death beyond what we have right now. And NIH is trying to do this. Their budget is obviously very strained. They've tried to do this by going beyond just funding early stage research and doing this molecular library screening center initiative, where they're actually trying to validate targets in-house at NIH, or not in-house, but fund researchers to validate targets, which is something way beyond what universities have traditionally done. So trying to basically move university research, push it down over the Valley of Death through just funding. And we'll see if any of that works.
Is there another recommendation we should make? Would you have to say something about software patents?
I think that there should be a presumption against pure software patents. You know, not an absolute bright line determination that they never work, but, you know, in law we often talk about rebuttable presumptions, and my view is it's a rebuttable presumption.
So maybe a different way to put that is that, a software patent needs to be motivated by some specific objective.
Yeah, so rather than the presumption being you get a patent, the presumption should be you don't get a patent until you come up with a good reason for it.
Okay, anything else?
No, I think I'm done.
Okay,
what
Steve.
What about the in-between hardware stuff?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, those are, that's great. I mean, that's just...
Sorry, what did you just say?
There's a huge, you made the, I'd never responded to that. There's a huge amount of stuff in between, and that's, oh boy, that's really, I have to think about that a lot more. And you're right, that there's a huge amount of stuff in between that, you know, that other 6% that isn't pure software, that it's kind of mixed up. Right. No, I know. And those are great questions.
Okay, Steve, what's your list?
I'm not sure I have a list for you, Ed, but I would offer a caution, and it's a trap I find we fall into at all these meetings, talking about software, talking about medical, talking about these categories. What we're experiencing most of all are complex combinations of these technologies. you really can't talk in terms of a strict software patent or a strict medical patent. John, are you still there?
John?
John is the CEO of an extremely interesting medical company that relies to some great extent on the use of manipulation of data, as are so many that we're seeing today. So to me, it may seem like a simplifying assumption. I think it's a very limiting assumption. And just to go one step further, I return to my earliest point that the report, at least as I see in some of the preliminary papers that I read, the report seems to be...
We didn't write those papers.
And, well, some of your contributors are on the committee.
Okay.
The report seems to take, maybe it's slight, but I detect it, a bias against the making of money either as a way of measuring or as a means of accomplishing a greater goal. And I think you have to be careful of that. Each time in this hour and a half that we've talked about social impact, people skirted back from any kind of measurement. Nobody wants to talk about measurement of social impact. And I would submit to you that you sit down in a university and you ask a group like this, how would you measure social impact? You'll get 30 answers. And some of them will be slightly different than the other one. And furthermore, they will be so subjective and so qualitative that even if you get one that sounds attractive, it won't be terribly meaningful. You know, I recall there's an old saying in the military that you find out what people are counting, and that's what you do. Mm-hmm. So
right.
When the CRADR program came out, people determined that, hey, they're counting CRADRs. Let's have as many CRADRs as we can. No consideration of the quality or the potential endpoint of the CRADR. Just let's have a CRADR. I used to be a Soviet trade negotiator. The Russians would say to a glass factory, make as much glass as you can. Okay, how do you measure it? Measure it by weight. Out came the thickest chunks of glass that you've ever seen, were totally unusable. So be careful what you decide to optimize against.
Dana?
Now, because the title is so broad, from concept to application, I think the first thing I would measure and try to increase is the number of students that are coming out, because we know from all the data that that's the best way to get innovation out. If you want to count that in some way, I'd give licenses to every graduate student when they leave the university, right? Say, here's a license to your work that you developed while you were here for you to go use at the company with which you work, and then you have an instant relationship. Maybe that's just an internal use license for a year or something like that, or maybe it's an option to a license or something, but you get that relationship in a tangible way. The second thing I do, I think goes back to Greg's recommendation of increase the connectivity between companies and universities, and that's through affiliates programs, through consulting, right, through any kind of relationship that you can have. And the third on my list would be non-exclusive licenses, because I think that's a way to achieve multiple relationships. And again, when I look at what I hear the university administration wanting, when I see in terms of the kinds of reports, Ed, you mentioned very early on, of companies that have come out of UW from Ken and Walter's study, all of that is through relationships that they had, and non-exclusive licenses are the one way to establish the most relationships that you ever can. I don't have a 4 and 5.
So let's hear some from the non-committee members of the audience, so as not to, and then we'll get to committee members. Please.
Thank you.
Got it, thanks. Any more comments? Got a few minutes left. Yes, please.
Speak back to what you were asking about how to accelerate transfer. And I apologize that I was going to be here yesterday. But I haven't heard you mention today at least what I see as an emerging discipline. I guess you talked a little bit earlier, but translational research. Boston University is a program that participates alongside the UW, Stanford, and six other universities, and a program that's been funded by the Wallace H. Kruger Foundation. And, you know, it's done for us what Deshpande did for MIT and what Ron Beebe did for UCSD. And I found that, you know, my office participates in that, and we found it extraordinarily effective. So one of the requirements of this is every grant has to have OPIs, a basic scientist or engineer, and a clinician. That has been enormously valuable in helping make sure that the technology is being correctly focused. One of the key criteria is one that acknowledges that the grants we can give are only the start of the pathway. So a key consideration is, in the evaluation of proposals, is how robust are their ideas for next stage follow-up funding. And then, frankly, these are not intended to fund basic science. If we see any basic discovery still needed, then that proposal is too early stage for this. And we want to see the funding is going into the proof of principle of the promotion of biopolitics and starting a second stream of development. I think the Kaufman Foundation review of this pandemic and of meeting is very helpful. Summary of this and gives good metrics and so forth. You know, the need for programs, something just about connectivity, to bring in mentors and then after mentors to bring in entrepreneurs and thinkers along with them. I think that's been very positive development.
One more comment? Wes, did you have something you wanted to say? I think we're done.
Thank you, and thank you to the panel members. We'll have a break for lunch.